Welcome to Talking Success, the podcast series that focuses on everything fintech. I'm your host, Alan Franks, and each week I'll be joined by a series of experts in the field who have a wealth of knowledge to share. It's time to meet this week's guest, so grab a coffee and let's start talking success.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Talking Success. For our regular listeners and viewers, you'll probably realise my background's slightly different. Well, I'm on location. I'm in Durban. My first time in Durban, which is fantastic. If you're in South Africa, I'd highly recommend a trip down to the coast. It's a fantastic place with great curries as well as other things. So I'm on location. I'm super excited to have Koen with me today. Koen Jonker, who's the CEO and founder of Time Bank, who I'm sure doesn't need much of an introduction, but we will get one nonetheless. I've got a load of questions for Koen today, and I'm going to start off, before he introduces himself, saying, well, I looked at your profile, Koen, right? We've not met before. We've had a couple of conversations in the past. When I typically look at sort of fintech or banking, digital banking entrepreneurs, they either come from the world of tech, so they're techies, or they're bankers. I don't think you're either of those, right? I think you came from a different route. I want to delve into that a little bit as well. But for everyone that doesn't know you and hasn't heard of Time Bank, where they've been living under a rock for the last 5 years, perhaps you could give us a very quick intro, who you are, who Time Bank is, and then we can get into the your background, your very interesting background.
Darren, thank you so much for having me. Look forward to our conversation. So Time is a multi-country digital banking group. We actually headquartered in Singapore. Time Bank is our flagship operation in South Africa. We're 4 years old. We have 7.5 million customers in South Africa. So roughly one in six people in South Africa who can have a bank account have a Time Bank account. Our passion is democratization of access to banking, focused on consumers and small businesses. We've also now launched our second bank, which is GoTime Bank in the Philippines, and we're close to our first million customers in the Philippines. So that's the short version of the story.
All right, fantastic. So how does a non-banker and a non-techie get into the world of banking? Well, sorry, digital banking.
Yeah, Darren, yeah, my background is in law. I actually started my life as a human rights lawyer in the early 90s. And at the time, my passion was sort of, human rights and equality and creating a fairer and a more democratic South Africa. And then we want political freedom and emancipation for all South Africans. And I thought, well, you know, I'm done with that. I'm going to become an M&A lawyer, which I did. Ended up being the managing partner of a firm called Edward Nathan, now Edward Nathan Sonnenbergs. I ran the law firm for 5 years. But at that time, it became more and more apparent to me that political freedom does not necessarily translate to economic empowerment, and that there's a big job to be done in economic empowerment. So I started getting really interested in this whole concept, this whole area of financial inclusion, economic agency, and the role that the private sector and banks can play in empowering people in their financial lives. So that was first an academic interest. Then I started teaching it. And at some point, I decided to make a career change. And it's sort of through this financial inclusion route that I actually became interested in digital banking as a means to an end, as what seemed to be the most sensible way to drive real democratization of finance.
It's very interesting. I was at an event a couple of weeks ago in Cairo, a banking event, and we were asked, I was wearing my FinTech Association hat, and I was asked to talk about the FinTech landscape here in South Africa. And I think I say that we because I've been in South Africa many years, are very proud of the fact that 80% of the population is banked, right? But I think it's very underbanked. Clearly, Time has had a big influence in that number, clearly. But there's a long way to go. You know, getting people utilizing bank accounts, digital bank accounts. And as Geeta was saying from Parza, that the challenge is, yes, they have a bank account. People have a bank account, but it's not only is it very transactional, but it's salary goes in and then cash gets withdrawn. So actually keeping the funds and the liquidity within the system digitally is actually quite a big challenge. And given a number of the products that TymeBank is certainly offering here in South Africa, we'll come on to the international side a bit later on, but the products you're offering here, the buy now, pay later, obviously the SME banking side, you know, all of these things are designed, if I'm not mistaken, to try and keep the digital economy at a level that it's sustainable. Have I read that right? Do I understand that correctly?
No, you're absolutely spot on. So, you know, the way we think about, let's call it transaction banking and savings. So when somebody starts using their phone and their debit or their credit card to start transacting rather than cash, that is really just a means to an end. The key to real democratization of finance is actually data. The idea that when I have a bank account, I'm financially included or I'm financially empowered, I think is only like a small part of the story. It's not untrue, but it's not the whole story. The whole story is that we only really develop economic agency in our lives, in our families' lives, and for our businesses when we have access to capital. And what we mean by access to capital is we can take the assets we have, including our future cash flows, and we can use that to get the cash we need to reinvest in our lives, in our families' lives, in our business, to grow our business. And so the end game is always access to capital. The starting point often is transactions. And the reason for that is only when you transact digitally that I can get to know you, that you come out of the darkness of the cash world, where the formal economy is really blind to you. You come into the light of digital data, and we can actually engage with you, and we can fund your business, or we can lend you money for consumer goods, or to build a house, or to put your children through university, and so on and so on. So the thing that you said about underbanked is exactly right. And this is not just true for very poor people. I think people in many parts of the economy, particularly business people, are chronically underbanked and chronically undercapitalized for what they need to really reach their full potential.
There's obviously a lot of challenges, but opportunities when having a digital bank. When you look at some of the incumbent banks and the products that they're offering, how does it compare? I mean, I know at the interest rate level in terms of saving, there really is no comparison. I've not seen an account that offers sort of 11% savings as TymeBank does. But on the other products and services, specifically, if we're talking, you mentioned sort of home improvement, and you mentioned education for children. When it comes to bonds here or mortgages here in South Africa, I feel that that's an area of the financial services that hasn't really been disrupted. It's quite opaque, I think probably is the best word. It is what it is, and there hasn't been much innovation around that. Do you see TymeBank or do you see there's room for disruption in that specific area?
Darren, yes, absolutely. You know, I think this journey of digitizing finance is a multi-year journey, and I think that we only sort of 5 or 10% into the potential of what can still be disrupted and digitized in this market. And for me, to some extent, home loans and vehicle and asset finance represents the furthest end of that evolution. So we're not there, TymeBank, today, partly because of how the system operates, partly of how difficult and expensive it is to develop those solutions. But I believe that the end game for South Africa is that somebody can buy and sell property significantly faster and cheaper and safer than they can today. And that probably requires us to take the deeds office onto the blockchain and to develop, to take the technology that's already out there and that's becoming more and more accepted and to use that as a platform to create a digital transformation in the way we see property, property rights, and the way that's actually tokenized and represented in the digital world. But we're certainly not there yet. And I think whoever gets it right, there's a big opportunity there.
And as you said, that's kind of the sort of the end road, right, or the end goal, and that's really sort of a bit further down the line. When we look at something that's kind of here and now, and let's talk about the growth of Timeback and the 6 million customers that you've acquired. You know, for those who don't know Timeback, maybe we've got some people from overseas that are looking at this, the route to market and the customer acquisition strategy was really, or is really, really unique. This is a blend of digital plus in-person, but without branches. And I'll let you unravel the rest, otherwise, because it's your story and I'm just sort of taking it in a sort of probably not describing it in the best way. But in terms of that acquisition strategy, which I think was absolutely phenomenal, if you can give our listeners a bit of an insight as to what that was, why that was deployed and how successful it's been.
Yeah, actually, you did quite a good job there, Darren. So the way we think about it is that, you know, the phone is a great tool to engage in financial services. But for many people, the process of opening a bank account or buying a funeral policy or getting a loan is quite an intimidating process. Mm. And going straight from living in the cash world to using my phone to open a bank account is quite hard for a lot of people. And so what we've seen as a pattern globally is that what I would call pure play digital banks have attracted a very particular profile of customer. They've sort of attracted the sort of digitally native, tech-savvy kind of customers, very heavy early adopters and wealthier customers. Now, when we started Timeback, our ambition was very clearly not to build a niche bank. Our ambition was to build a mass market bank for all South Africans that would make it possible for anyone to have a bank account and use a bank account, empower people. And so what we did is we created two new channels. We created what we call the kiosk. So that is a sort of a stand-up kiosk, looks like an ATM, but it's actually just a sales and service channel where you can open a bank account in about 3.5 minutes. The bank account is immediately live. It prints you a debit card, and you walk away with a live debit card after 3.5 minutes. And it does also, you can reset your PIN, you can replace your card, you can do other things, you can buy a funeral policy and so on at that kiosk. And what we then did is we employed young people from the local communities in which we operate to essentially be there next to the kiosk as brand ambassadors, and their only job was to get you comfortable with the technology and to explain to you how the product works and get you comfortable with our products. And then the other channel that we created was a cash deposit and withdrawal channel at the checkout counter in the retail store. So if you're the kind of person where even an ATM is a bit intimidating for you, you could actually just go to the checkout counter, and the person working there at the checkout counter will help you deposit and withdraw cash into your account. And those channels have been hugely successful for us. You know, we've got about 80% of our 7.5 million customers have actually come through that channel, although you can sign up to a Timeback account just using your phone or using your PC or your tablet. So 80% of our customers have come through that channel. And now if we look at South Africa and the Philippines, we are now growing at around 1 million customers every 3 months. And 80% of them are still coming through that channel.
Amazing. I want to delve into the Philippines in a moment. I've just got a couple of questions, if I may. Was there a need for regulatory change in order to allow consumers to be able to open up a bank account without a wet signature and without having to provide any sort of document. So was there work that was done behind the scenes with the BASA and the various different sort of associations and Saab here in South Africa and FCA?
Darren, yes, that's I guess where being a lawyer became a little bit useful in this world. We think about the relationship with the regulator very much as a partnership. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an old saying in law that the law follows a respectful distance behind technology. And what we can't afford in our business is for that respectful distance to be too far. So we've spent over the years a lot of time working with regulators here and elsewhere in the world to convince them to allow new things to happen. And one of them was the way in which we open accounts. And we're very lucky in South Africa. We have a very progressive and open-minded regulator who was keen to not only build a banking system that is safe, but one that is accessible for everyone. But we actually, with the South African regulator, we actually ended up trailblazing in a few areas. The one was actually building a bank in the cloud. So TymeBank has run end-to-end on AWS cloud. And we were the first bank, certainly the first in Africa. We think possibly, one of the first three banks in the world to run a bank in the cloud. And that required regulatory change. It required a lot of education, probably about a year of hard work to make that change. And then, although the regulations were quite good around account opening, and South Africa particularly, actually by the time we launched, didn't require wet signatures, there were changes and evolution required and collaboration required. And so I always say to any fintech entrepreneur, you cannot see the regulator as your enemy. And no. I personally don't like a strategy to try and get around the regulator. You absolutely have to build that partnership and that mutual respect if you want to build a sustainable business.
Yeah, I completely agree. And then there's another bit of innovation as well before we come on to the international side. And I wasn't aware of this until I did my research prior to this call. But you have a soft POS solution as well for your merchants, which I've been harping on about for the last year and a half, going, I don't understand the sort of the physical POS market. I think it's had its time. No pun intended. I don't know why you would need a physical device if I've got an Android or I've got a Huawei phone or an iOS phone and I can take payments, especially as a micro merchant. I understand for a big retailer, they're going to need something a little bit more sort of robust or a little bit more complex. But how's the uptake been on soft POS within your sort of SME market?
Yeah, firstly, I think that's right, that form factor is less and less important. You know, was it Horowitz who said software is eating the world? You don't no longer need hardware modules. You can have software modules, download the app on your phone and use it. And it's a great solution. We've seen good uptake. I would say not as fast as we would like, but I don't think that's a demand issue. I don't think our product is as good as we'd like it to be. And so I think that there's no doubt that the world is going in that direction where less and less people will require a standalone device to take payments. But then there's an interesting new thing coming that we've seen working very well in other markets, and that is on the back of PayShop, the rapid payment protocol that we've implemented in South Africa, is the ability to use a QR code as a form factor for payment. I think the interesting next step, so whereas a soft POS or a software POS on the phone potentially replaces a old school point of sale machine, the next step is potentially any one of us can simply print a QR code, slap it on the front of our shop, and anyone who has a bank account can simply scan the QR code and pay us through this QR code. And now you're in a world where actually the card rails are no longer even in play when you are making payments, micro payments in communities in the informal sector and so on.
I thought what was interesting, again, when I was doing my research, was peer-to-peer payments in terms of it, a time bank customer to time bank customer is free of charge. There's no charge to do that. Do you see a play for time bank to integrate with PayShap, like some of the other banks have done, or not?
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
So, Darren, without giving too much away around our strategy, let me say this. We have seen the power of free or near free real-time peer-to-peer payments in markets like India, the Philippines, Vietnam, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and other markets. And we think that it's unstoppable. At some point, we will have free or near free peer-to-peer digital payments. And then by the time we get there, The thing that gets disrupted is not card payments. The thing that gets disrupted is cash, because suddenly it becomes as easy and as cheap to move money digitally as it is in people's perception to move money taking cash out of their wallets. And to my mind, the question is not whether we get there. It's simply how fast do we get there, and who's going to lead it.
I think when we're looking at sort of the financial inclusion side, you know, for me to give you R5 out of my wallet cost me R5. For me to give you R5 out of my bank account as it is at the moment, it might cost me R6.50 or R6, whatever the prices are set by the banks. That doesn't incentivize me, who's, you know, lower LSM, to move digitally, because it's going to cost me more money. I think you're right. If we can, I know it's a bit of a race to the bottom in terms of, you know, margins and slices and dices for schemes and what have you, but I think it's inevitable. We won't talk about cross-border payments. That's probably one for another day. But let's talk on to the internationalization side. The majority of fintechs the majority of fintechs here in South Africa or in Africa, when they look at expanding, they typically look at neighboring countries, right? Or they look at, you know, the big four. They look at Ghana, they look at Nigeria, they look at Kenya, they look at South Africa. Now, time banks in Philippines, soon to be Pakistan, how did that come about? What was the reason? Obviously, I appreciate that the HQ is in Singapore, is in Asia Pac anyway, so that's that sort of region. But where was that thought process? Why not the rest of Africa? Or is that something that may come in the future?
Yeah, you know, we're very passionate about Africa. We'd love to do more in Africa. And we have tried to do things in Africa. So we've seriously looked at Africa. The way we think about the strategy of expansion is you want to expand to a market that is most suited to your model. So where the strength of how you do business can play to best advantage. And if you think about our model, as I've described it before, what we really need when we go into a new market is we need a market with a progressive regulator that will allow us to do banking in the cloud and digital KYC and onboarding. You need a country with a digital KYC system. You need a country with strong formalized retail, where you can actually put these kiosks down in retail stores that can accommodate them, and you can integrate into their checkout counters. And then you need a big population of young, digitally savvy people who will be open to doing banking in this new way. And we looked at the entire world, and outstandingly, the market that suited our model best was the Philippines. on every one of those characteristics. Of course, the Philippines, double the size of South Africa, 100 million people, 70% of people in the Philippines have never had a bank account.
Wow.
But the Philippines is growing at 6%, the highest social media penetration in the world, the highest gaming penetration in the world. It's almost just perfect for our model. So that was sort of the thought process that was behind going into the market. And then we were lucky enough that they then decided to issue digital banking licenses that had lower capital requirements than traditional banks. So we applied for one of those licenses. We found a partner in the Philippines, a partner by the name of the Gokongwe Group, the third largest family conglomerate in the Philippines, largest retail group in the Philippines. We were lucky to get a great partner and to get a license. And now, as they say, it's history. We're almost at 1 million customers and growing roughly at twice the pace that we predicted in our forecasts.
And I'm not going to say it was a cookie-cutter approach, but very similar model in terms of the go-to-market, the product offering that you had in South Africa. Was it quite easy to sort of transpose that into the Philippines, or there quite a bit of modification that needed to happen?
You know, I think a big part of the success of taking a model from one market to the other is to figure out which parts are the same and which parts need modification. So you're quite right, the model is the same. So it's kiosks, it's retail partnerships, it's starting with transactions and savings as the core proposition with loyalty. So a lot is the same, but we actually use the Philippines as an opportunity to actually build, let's call it version 2.0 of what we did in South Africa, and learn from the mistakes, do it much better. And we ended up doing it faster, doing it better, and doing it significantly cheaper than we did it the first round in South Africa.
And talking about sort of the expense of launching into a new market, I think for any entrepreneur, it's an expensive venture. But as a bank, I imagine it's probably, multiple times of that. But, Time Bank raised a Series B, I think it was $70 million, beginning of this year, back end of last year, I think it was, if I'm not mistaken. What is that sort of capital being used for? Is it other markets? Is it focusing on the South African market and the Filipino market? How are you utilizing those funds?
Yes, so we're very happy to say that South Africa doesn't need more money. So we've raised all the money we needed for South Africa to get South Africa to profitability. And we now have enough capital in South Africa to run the business. So the business is at a point where it's sort of generating the capital that it needs to keep going. So the new money that we're raising now, all going into the Philippines. And a bit of a news update, Darren, is that we've made the call not to go into Pakistan, and we're currently far advanced in negotiations to go into Vietnam as our third country. So Vietnam also very interesting, also around 100 million people, 98% employment in the country, a young, very optimistic and young population. So we're quite excited about Vietnam potentially being our third market.
Fantastic. Well, best of luck. I didn't know that. So thank you for sharing it with us. If we look sort of round the globe a little bit more, and we come to South America, I think there's a lot of fintechs in Africa that are going, actually, the demographics are quite similar. The challenges, the financial inclusion side. Do you see that in the future in sort of South America being a play for you guys, or are you quite happy in sort of Asia Pac and Africa?
You're right. The other market that actually suits our model very well is Mexico, which sort of Latin American market, and other South American countries are potentially great countries to go into. And in fact, I would say the bank we admire most in the world is Nubank in Brazil, And they started in Brazil, then went to Mexico and to Colombia. And so, yes, I would say Africa, South America, Southeast Asia, and South Asia, probably the areas in the world where these kinds of models are best suited. Interestingly, the reason I've been pushing back against South America, and there have been opportunities from there that have come our way, the reason I've been pushing back is sort of the time zone problem, the stretch on the team. So currently, the team sits in a sort of a nine-hour time zone between the guys who are most west and most east. And I think sort of that 6 to 9 hours, if you want to stay sane in a fast-growing business, is probably as much of a stretch as I feel up to at the moment. Maybe one day we grow up, then we sort of work around the globe, but we're not there yet.
No,
for me now, you know, East Africa, North Africa, maybe even Eastern and Southern Europe and Southeast Asia, it's probably just in terms of keeping things together and keeping our sanity. It's probably more where we will be looking at.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, kind of, it was interesting, right? So, I wasn't sure sort of how this conversation was going to sort of what angles we were going to take, and I was thinking about some of the other sort of challenger banks here, digital banks here in South Africa, some of the others in Europe, you know, the Revoluts and the N26s and the Starling banks and what have you, and I think they've all come from very different backgrounds in terms of how they were formed. And this is not knocking any other of the banks that I've just mentioned or any others, but, you know, with a financial inclusion first mentality, which is, you know, how do we build a bank for everyone? And, you know, if me as an individual, I want certain benefits or I want certain applications or I want everything bundled into one app, then fine, I've got an option. But for the, you know, the rest of the population, if they just need to get that first sort of step on the ladder, they need to be able to, you know, use a bank facility to help them grow their SME or micro business. They need to be able to save in order to fund an education or a car or vehicle or whatever it may be. You know, that's kind of the mindset of Time Bank. I think that's been very enlightening for me. I wasn't aware of that story. So very enlightening. Thank you for sharing it with us. In terms of the future of banking in South Africa, let's just bring it back home for a moment. Where do you see that going? And particularly if we look at the incumbent banks, where do you see them being in 5-10 years time?
Darren, that's a big conversation. So I'll just give you a few thoughts and then you can sort of guide me as to what you think is interesting to go into more deeply. You know, I think the first thing to say, and I do hear other people saying this, South Africa has formidable banks. The quality of the banking industry, the quality of the banks, the quality of service is street's ahead of many other places in the world and even some of the most developed countries in the world. And it's interesting, we see it comparing South Africa to the Philippines. In the Philippines, we've got many more competitors, but the competitors, quite frankly, are not as good as the competitors in South Africa. And so, you know, the one thing I wouldn't do is sort of lightly bet against the incumbent banks and their ability to provide customers with a great service. Having said that, the existing banks, the incumbent banks, have one enormous challenge, and that is what I would call a structural cost disadvantage. So if you compare what we do in Time Bank, our cost per customer is less than a tenth of the cost per customer of the big banks. Mm. Now, that is a lot of money to give back to customers by way of savings, to give to investors and to give to partners to help us deepen our access to banking. And so at some point, the incumbents are going to have to face this structural cost problem they have if they want to be serious about banking, let's call it the mass market, most South Africans, if they don't just want to be in investment, corporate, business, and let's say private banking. The second is the scourge of technology legacy. You know, there's this this Irish story about a guy on a country road who stops and asks the Irish farmer, you know, he shows the place, I need to go here. How do I get to this place from here? And the farmer says, if I were you, I wouldn't start here. And now this is the problem with big banks, is that the entire technology stack, the way in which the bank is built, does not provide you with a sensible path to cutting the costs by 90 or 95%. You can maybe, if you really work hard, cut the cost by 5 or 10%, but that's not the order of magnitude cost improvement that you're looking for. And so I think that combination means that if big banks are serious about competing with people like us, they're going to have to make a fresh start. They're going to have to actually start something on the side that looks completely different from what they're doing. Having said that, we know that there are some segments of customers who still love the branch, who still want that sort of safety or the security of the branch. And so they will be, in the same way as there were people who still use checkbooks still until fairly recently, there will be people, there will be a tail of people who will continue to prefer the incumbents or the way in which banking works through the incumbents.
Very interesting. I recorded a podcast a few weeks ago with Diamond Trust Bank in Kenya. And despite them going on a huge digital transformation journey, they're opening another 500 branches, right? So digital transforming, but recognizing the fact that a lot of their customers in Kenya and Tanzania, I think it is, you know, still want to go into the bank because that's where they are comfortable. That's where actually it's quite a social gathering as well. And they can't take that away because they will lose customers. So it's finding that balance. But as a smaller bank in Diamond Trust Bank, I think it's slightly easier to do, albeit they've been around for 80 odd years. If you look at some of the big banks here in South Africa, I mean, I drive past a building of one of the banks every day, and that particular branch of or building of that branch is just for vehicle loans, right? And I go, what do all these people do? I mean, surely. And this is just one building. You know, and I'm not for one minute suggesting that there needs to be a mass culling or mass retrenchments here, but, you know, with the, you know, with technologies that are coming out, the advancements of AI, the advancements of machine learning, all of these other sort of topical technologies that are coming out, I think, you know, there's going to be some reshaping, resizing at some point. And I think the brave ones that do that sort of sooner will probably, you know, still survive. I'm not saying the banks are going anywhere because they clearly have a big place in the economy and in the financial services sort of ecosystem. But I think, you know, digitization is not just about technology. It's, you know, cultural, it's, you know, it's OPEX, it's everything, isn't it? So interesting to see what happens, I think.
You know, and it's about brand promise. So one of the reasons big banks can't get rid of branches is because that's the promise they gave. And it's very difficult to change that social contract with their customers to say, you no longer have that. So, and that's why pure digital players or digital banks like ours, who create where we create a very specific kind of channel to do the work of the branch, we can do that because we never provided the brand promise of we'll give you a branch. We were clear from day one, if you come to us, you're not going to have that thing. And that works. I think it's extremely difficult once you've got the branch there, extremely difficult to take it away.
Yeah, because I think if it's seen as the branch is closing down, that has negative, you know, that sort of forms negative thoughts about, you know, that bank and the commitment to the community or wherever else it may be. So I get that. Could my very, very last question, and then I'm going to let you go and get on with your day of running a bank rather than talking to me, I promise. But how do you retain customers? And let me just unpack that a little bit, because, you know, it's so easy nowadays to open up a bank account. Right. As you said, it takes 3.5 minutes at a kiosk with Time Bank. I can open up another bank account on my phone. I can open up 3 or 4 bank accounts on my phone. how do you ensure there's stickiness? How do you ensure that, you know, your customers stay within TymeBank and are, you know, and are lifelong? Because you've obviously spent, even though it's a tenth of the cost of acquiring than, you know, the incumbent banks, there's still a cost. You need to recover that cost to make sure that, you know, those people are still with you in X, you know, months, years time. How do you do that?
You know, one of the exciting things, Darren, about the world in which we live is that customers have choice and they're able to, if they're not happy, they're able to move. So ultimately, you know, you're only as successful as you are popular with customers. And customers have to love what you give them. And so I think a lot of the key here is in the customer service area. But it's also anticipating what the customer will want next. So we invest quite heavily into what we call our recommendation engine, which is essentially using AI and customer behavioral patterns to understand what a customer needs today and what they're most likely to need next after they've done something. So in the same way as your natural language models simply predicts the next best word to put in the sentence. Our recommendation engine simply predicts the next best thing that you're most likely to want to learn or most likely to want to do. And it is a question of building the thing for you that you're most likely to want next and making sure that the experience of using that is an empowering experience. And if you get that right, your customers just use you more and more. They might start by only using you as a savings account or to send money to their family or to put a bit of money aside for that their spouse can't see or whatever the case may be. And then the trick is just to keep in that relationship, keep nudging the customer to say, what about this? You know, and nudge them to do the right thing at exactly the right time that works for them. And in this way, you know, when we started, our customers did on average, maybe 2.5 or 3 things with us a month. Now our average customer does 11 things with us a month. Wow. And that will just keep growing.
Amazing. I guess ultimately, though, because you're a bank and you're not necessarily a fintech, it's about trust, right? It's about trust. People need to trust a bank. They need to trust their bank, which is why I think a lot of people stick with, you know, who their mother and father bank with, who their grandparents bank with, certainly here in South Africa and so on and so forth. You know, I think building trust is so, so critical because, you know, we look in the other side of the world, or not the world, but the other side of the market, and we look at the world of crypto and we've seen FTX, and we've seen this one, and we've seen that one, and we've seen all this, you know, and it's just made people shudder because there's no trust now in that sort of part of the market. You know, is there a strategy to retain or not even regain, because I don't think you've ever lost trust, but to build trust in something that, you know, a consumer can't walk into a branch and go to the branch manager and say, hey, listen, where's my money? Is that, again, a cultural shift? Is that about education? Or how does that work?
Yeah, trust is at the heart of it. Trust is hard won and easily lost. And so, you know, I think for us, we know that we're still in the process of building trust. We know it's a long-term game. You always have to be, you know, at the top of your game, never let customers down. And so, you know, consistent high performance is key to trust. Being associated with other trusted brands, when we go into a new market, we make sure we associate with retailers that are very trusted, other brands that are very trusted, loyalty programs that are trusted. So you trust a new brands based on the other brands they hang out with. That plays a role. But ultimately, the only way to be trusted is to be very deeply trustworthy. So we invest very heavily in making sure that our compliance processes, our risk management, the way in which we help customers deal with things like fraud and so on, you know, is best of breed. And it's just an ongoing commitment to day-to-day improvement to be worthy of customers' trust. But the nice thing is that trust and great customer experience go well together, because as long as you have a great experience with a brand, you're likely to also deepen your trust as you go.
You absolutely are. Kun, thank you very, very much. I am going to let you go back to running a bank now. I might go and dip my toes in the sea before I drive back 8 hours to Joburg tomorrow. So I've really, really enjoyed this chat. Thank you so very, very much. If people don't sort of know where to find you, I guess sort of look you up on LinkedIn. I know you're quite active on there. You know, have a look at Time Bank. We'll post some links, you know, at the bottom. If you're listening on Spotify, you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we'll put the links there. If you're on YouTube, they're sort of down here somewhere. So feel free to click around. Thank you again very, very much. Thank you to your team as well for facilitating this. And good luck in Vietnam.
Thank you, Darren.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of Talking Success. Thank you so much for tuning in and joining us for this fascinating discussion on all things fintech. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and have gained some valuable insights into the ever-evolving world of finance and technology. A huge thank you to our guests for sharing their expertise and providing us with some amazing insights. We certainly couldn't have done this without them. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and stay tuned for more exciting conversations with experts in the field. Until next time, keep learning, keep growing, and keep talking success.